Good afternoon. Welcome to today's Olson Seminar, continuing our series named in honor of Paul Olson, of course. I'm Rick Edwards, the director of the Center for Great Plains Studies. Before we get to our speaker today, I'd like to introduce Amber Moore, the curator of the Great Plains Art Museum, to tell us a little bit about what we're seeing on the walls around us. Amber?
Thank you, Rick. I'd like to add my welcome on behalf of the Great Plains Art Museum. I've seen many of you here many times before for lectures and other art-related events at the museum, and I hope I see the others of you again sometime. We have two exhibitions right now on our first floor space. In our Chris Lieben South galleries, we have Marking the Prairie Sublime, paintings and prints by Jonathan Gooding. These are artworks by a local artist who's from Lincoln, actually has his undergraduate degree from UNL. And his work explores the sublime, the awe, the transcendent wonder in the prairie landscape. And our West Gallery has a selection from our permanent collection of paintings, drawings, and prints that similarly show that aspect of the sublime in the prairie landscape. And we've just opened an exhibition on our lower level. The co-curator is right here, Alicia Harris, in the audience. It's called Confrontations and Conciliatory Acts, Art and Artifacts of United States and Sioux Nation Conflict. That is in conjunction with the upcoming symposium on 1862. So if you have time to look at that, it's open downstairs in the Lens Gallery. Thank you.
Thank you, Amber. Amber mentioned our symposium, 1862 to 2012, The Making of the Great Plains. And this spring, we chose our Olson lecturers from among people whose research is associated with or focuses on topics related to that symposium. After the symposium, on April 11, a little bit of bad planning. After the symposium, there will be another one, Olson lecture on this topic. Professor Ed Harvey from the School of Natural Resources here at UNL will speak on Reflections on the Moral Act and the Man for Whom It's Named. We tried to get that one in before the symposium, but he's in Holland and won't be back until early April. So I invite you to come back on April 11 for that discussion. Today's Olson lecture is Professor Dennis Smith, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Professor Smith earned an MA from the University of Montana and a PhD from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, studying with somebody in the history department, John Wunder, one of our favorites. He also taught at Morningside College in Sioux City, Iowa. He started teaching in the fall of 2002 at UNO. He is an enrolled member of the Assiniboine tribe of the Fort Peck Reservation in Montana. Now, you need to know at least a couple of other things about Denny. One thing is, as he says on his website, he likes listening to both kinds of music, both country and Western. And he's also the proud father of three smart and accomplished young women, one of whom, Paula, is here with us today. Welcome. Let me also say that Professor Smith is an invaluable member of our symposium planning committee, and Denny, thank you for your work on that. His talk today is entitled 19th Century Fort Peck Assiniboine Cultural Persistence.
Well, Rick, you probably noticed on the first thing on my notes was to thank you. You probably saw that. But that's where we should start anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, I do appreciate it. And Rick has been really good to me in the past year. And it's an honor for me to be involved in the symposium. And I miss the center a lot. It's so good to be with these people. I kind of pay my regards to people who've helped me and taught me. So my UNO colleagues and faculty, I've been there 10 years. And I just learn from these people, and anyway, it's a privilege to do that. And now, in terms of, no one's ever heard of me, and I understand that. I haven't really published much, but I've spent a lot of time on studying my reservation. And so I want to talk a little bit about what I have to offer. And in terms of being a scholar, I guess I'm a scholar, but, you know, everybody else has published a great deal. But I have done good work. But all of that, I owe to Dr. Wunder. So anything I know as an academic, as a professional, I owe to John Wunder. And all of us that are his students, we just revere him. We all owe him. We could never pay him back for how he takes care of graduate students. I mean, it just couldn't be better. So I've been negligent because I've kind of been busy, and so I'll try to get back in touch. But so I like to think of John as St. John because that's what he is to all of us. Then I wanted to say a couple words about all these cultural elders I worked with. I don't need to name them. I want to get done on time. We have like about 45 minutes. But for me, I came to Native American Studies back home at our tribal college, and it was in 1983. I was there 2 years. And then in 1989, I came to Morningside College. I was the Indian Studies director, and that's in Sioux City. Now, when I came there in 1989, I'm a young, learning scholar. I wouldn't even call myself a scholar, really. I'm just young, kind of getting started. I had a master's. But all the people in the community treated me like I really knew things. I was the Indian Studies director. When, in fact, I mean, I had a certain amount of academic background, but I was always the student. And it was, maybe it was just that institution, and maybe they just had built good relations with the community, which they had. It was unbelievable. So I tell my students that I'm going to tell you stories, and these aren't my stories. These are just what these people told me. They didn't have to tell me these things. Me, a nobody. So I pass them on. But I always tell students, I don't know if they believe it, that I feel so lucky about that, because some people never get that. That's how I started. That make sense? Well, I don't understand that, but it was truly unbelievable down there. So there's some elders I won't mention their names. And I have some other Lakota people who have been good to me and my students who are Lakota. And then I mentioned my cultural people back home, Assiniboine. And what I understand culturally is through all these people who have taught me. And I've also just been there for cultural things. And I've been part of our Sundance Society. We called it a medicine lodge back home for over 20 years. And, well, I don't really know that much. I danced and I did various things, but I don't claim any expertise compared to our singers and our medicine man. But in some way, I learned things culturally. So I thank all those cultural people, because compared to Dr. Wunder, Rick, I mean, I just haven't read enough to really be that kind of a scholar, but I do have things to offer in terms of culture. So that we'll get to that today, because I have kind of strong feelings about some of those things. Now, the theme of the notes, and Rick, you probably noticed I have a different title here than what I booked. This is probably truer. And so I want to focus on oral tradition and oral stories. Many of you know about that. But I had a couple experiences when I interviewed elders that were kind of mind-boggling. So I want to explain at least one of those. And so a couple things about Fort Peck Reservation. And this has not been the best technology day or two, so I'm hoping this thing's going to work. Okay? If it doesn't, we're going to shut it off. So anyway, from Fort Peck Reservation, it's in northeast Montana. Now, when a presenter puts a map up, please try to stay awake. The point is to not bore you to tears. So this is just sort of background. And that came out pretty clear, actually. I'm surprised. Now, I spent a lot of time looking at maps, trying to get the right map that has the land formations that are important. And, of course, no map has everything that you'd like, of course. And most of the ones I have here are from Raymond DeMalley's chapters in the Handbook of North American Indians. This is his Assiniboine chapter, and I couldn't get rid of all the Canadian stuff, but this is my best shot at kind of focusing on Montana. So, those of you may know the West. This is kind of our neck of the woods here, and I don't know if you can see this little tiny red dot. Does that work if I do it? Otherwise, I'd have to walk over there and use the scroller thing. It's not going to happen. So, anyway, this is the Fort Peck region. It's northeast Montana, 60 miles from Saskatchewan and 60 miles from North Dakota. But just in context, it's the Upper Missouri River area, and the whole story and the historic period for us in the more recent times, 19th century, all in this region. And this is the Fort Peck Reservation. Today I'm going to show you a couple older historic maps to give you a feel for the 1870s, especially the period that I focused on. Now, in the failed attempts to drag images from the web onto PowerPoint, which I've always done, or crystal clear, this is not crystal clear, but I decided to put it up because it does something very informative, and it shows this reddened area of what then was Montana Territory. And in the period that I studied, which is primarily the late 1860s, 1870s up through 1888, the whole story in Montana was this was one large reservation. Very odd. I mean, I didn't know that till later in my studies. But the fact of the matter is, in terms of just federal Indian lands, this was one huge northern reservation from the line of North Dakota, present-day North Dakota, to the slope of the Rockies. I mean, it's just strange. It was an enormous area. Now, there are Native people in other places, of course. Does that make sense? There weren't that many white people, but this is kind of the landscape in terms of policy and law and all these little boundary things that they had to deal with. And I like this map just because it has some landmarks here, and it has another image of the Fort Peck Reservation today that didn't exist in the period that I studied, and that was created in 1888. Now, I have all kinds of details about my family. We don't need to do that. But me, I'm all Irish looking, and I have blue eyes. But I am an enrolled member of my tribe. And over time, I actually learned things about who we are and all kinds of things. When I was young, I didn't know that. And my father was not taught anything by my grandmother. So he lived in an all-Indian world. I'm going to talk about him. But he didn't know anything about the culture. She didn't teach him the language that she knew. She didn't teach him anything about ceremony, which is what happened in that generation. So it took me a while to get up to speed, and I wasn't having an identity crisis. But I actually was kind of not quite on my game. Does that make sense? And that changed. Now I'm going to talk about my dad in that, as I look back, I'm different than everybody I know. And I'm just so serious about hunger and starvation for tribes. I mean, I'm like, I'm off the charts. And I'm not paranoid, and I'm not morose. But when I looked at scholarship and the depiction of Native white experience especially, I was like, what is wrong with our scholars? What are they doing? They're not talking about these things? Does that make sense? I mean, I was, like, very critical. And then as I thought about it, it's because of what my dad told me. So I'm just going to tell you a couple things about what he told me. It shaped everything because I was kind of late to the scholarship of history. So my dad was born in 1908 in Poplar on the reservation. He lived in an all-Indian world. And it's odd, of course, because he didn't know anything about being a Assiniboine. Didn't know the language, didn't know the ceremonies. He was with Indian people his whole life. And he didn't seem to have a problem. Does that make sense? But it's kind of odd, it seems to me. I never felt that he had issues related to that, but you could clearly see that there were something he probably didn't quite understand. So, like me and my oldest younger brother, we're really interested in being a Assiniboine, and my two other siblings, not that interested. And so my brother and I, we're just talking to my dad. Dad, tell us what it was like. I mean, we're just like relentless. Tell us everything since 1980 that you remember. Does that make sense? So I did that, and I don't remember when it was. I think it was like undergraduate time, probably earlier. I don't remember exactly. And my dad was born in 1908, and the things he told me, I was shocked. I was like, Dad, what are you talking about? I mean, I knew enough to know that at some point in the late 1870s, 1880s, we had a hard time. But my dad was talking about the 19-teens. And he said, everybody was hungry and starving on the reservation. I said, Dad, what are you talking about? You know, it's rations. The Wild West days are over. I was like, Dad, what are you talking about? I mean, I was incredulous. And over time, I realized he's not making it up. He's just telling me what he saw and experienced. And it was true. And I was dumbfounded. It's like, Dad, that's not even possible. Now, my study of our reservation, I now see, well, I shouldn't be so shocked. We were cheated of food and denied and neglected. I mean, it's horrible. But I thought it would get better in the early 20th century. It didn't. So that changed how I saw things, as things that I read and things that I studied. And, of course, I had zero tolerance for scholars who didn't talk about it. I could see where they understood the concept, but they weren't apparently offended. And I certainly had no sympathies for the Indian Affairs Office and others that's what they did. Knowing this is the 19th century, this wasn't going to go well for everybody, knowing that. Does that make sense? So anyway, that's where I came from. And so for me, it's just like, it's like a different world every time I study documents, because to me, it's just in almost everything that you read. Does that make sense? So, but I'm not like other people. This is just the way I orient. We're special cases for Peck because we suffered more than others in that regard. Other tribes suffered in other ways. But what I realized back home was they don't even know that back home to the degree that maybe I do. Does that make sense? Anyway, so that's my orientation. It might be biased. It might be a preoccupation. But I think the record shows that. So I want to tell you a couple things about what my dad said. And we don't need to have many details. But now, he said, now he was born in 1908, so his memories go back to about 1912, 13. Now, he lived on the east end of the reservation with my grandmother and family, and they farmed all the way and had a cattle herd 30 miles north. So they had sort of an operation that was right on the Missouri River bottom. I mean, this thick, wooded Missouri bottom lands, and 30 miles of open prairie, no fences. And that's where my grandfather ran our summer herd. So it was a 30-mile radius on the east end of the reservation. And Dad said there was no game. He said there was none there. And he said the reason was because the native people, the Indian people, ate everything, he said. Now, I come from a hunting family. My dad was the hunter of all time. And so if my dad said that, he has no agenda. He's just telling me what he saw. Does that make sense? So a couple things struck out at me, and then we'll move on, because I don't want to say this to be mean-spirited to what happened. But just as an idea to me, because I'm interested in oral history, I'm interested in oral memory. And so my dad just told me these images that he had. So the one that stunned me always was, he said, on the east end of the reservation, he said Indian people would take young hawks from their nests and have to eat them. Hawks. Raptors. I mean, we revere raptors. That's shocking. I've never heard of that anywhere. But that's what he said. Okay? He told me on the west end of the reservation, we had a lot of Assiniboine celebrations, Sundances and county fairs and all kinds of festivities. And that's more on the west side of the reservation, which is the Assiniboine side. Huge gatherings, he said. And he said it was very odd back then because when they were feeding, he said a lot of times they were just eating gophers, snaring gophers because they had nothing else to eat. Now, I understand how Native people live off the land, but I think gophers are at the bottom of the food chain in terms of, you know, what you normally eat. Does that make sense? He told me other details. We don't need to worry about the grisly details of what he observed, but you couldn't make it up, and it was just everything that my dad said. It's true. I recorded him, and I listened to it, and it was even more impressive to me, everything that he said. I'd heard it all my life, but I listened to everything that I recorded him on it. It was stunning, the details that he had. Does that make sense? I mean, this is just what happened. So I think it's true, and that's really an oral tradition. It's an oral story from my family of sorts. Now, because I guess I'm on a hunger theme with my dad and things, and he told me other things. He was just a little guy. He didn't give me the ages, probably about 8, maybe 10, but he said we were just little kids. And my grandmother sent them to a boarding school in Rapid City. He said, you know, he was with his older brother, and he said, you know, we were in these little army uniforms. We're just little kids at this boarding school. I didn't know that till he told us that. Does that make sense? Well, I mean, that's off-reservation boarding school experience. But then, of course, he told me, you know, we were always hungry. This is a federal off-reservation boarding school. That's well known in the off-reservation boarding schools. That's life. Federal government didn't have money. It's a complicated story. But the fact of the matter is, all the off-reservation boarding schools I know, students weren't starved, probably not malnutrition, but they certainly weren't fully fed, it seems to me. There's exceptions. I'm not an authority on all of that. Does that make sense? But that's what he told me. And again, this is in the 20th century. This is a, you know, off-reservation boarding school. This is not 1879 and Carlisle and other places that were horrible in some ways. Does that make sense? So the thing that's very cultural that he told me was, well, what we did is all these, you know, we're just little young Indian kids. He said, we go to the stream that goes through Rapid City and we catch fish. He didn't say trout, whatever kind of fish. And they take him into the kitchen, the back door of the kitchen, and an Indian woman who was the cook would cook those fish up for him. And the way he talked about it was, that wasn't her job, and she was doing it because she's Indian. Does that make sense? Well, you wouldn't know that in a document, but that was the reality of this system. Kids came to her, they're just hungry, and looks like it worked pretty well. But that's all off the record, it seems to me. So, of course, for me, it's still about hunger in one degree or another. That make sense? So, again, I mention that simply because that's a reminiscence. That's his memory of the past. You couldn't make it up. And the details that he talked about, I just think you it's got to be pretty true. Now, let's move on because I want to get to the stories. Turn my watch upside down. Now, in my research, I have about 4 or 5 stories I just want to play around with. And I think I'll do them in short form so we can maybe talk about other details of those or anything else if you want. Now, in the 1860s, right, you can almost date it to 1862, in the Missouri River, Upper Missouri River, upstream from Fort Pierre, not many people appreciate that the whole Upper Missouri River was on fire. I mean, the Yanktonais and some Lakotas said no more white traffic on the Missouri River, and it was a war zone. Now, the story of combat and Native wars in this area, that's really a story of the 1870s, and it's all Lakotas, which is absolutely true. The fact of the matter is, this was a dangerous place beginning in 1862. That make sense? So I have a story I found about that. And in the winter of 1866, the Indian agent who was downstream at a place called Fort Berthold, he was, which is, let's see, it's on one of the maps. And it was so dangerous, this is 1866, that he feared for his life at this Indian agency in remote Fort Berthold. So he went upstream to Fort Union. I think Fort Berthold, it's not here. Fort Union is, but there's one of these maps that has Fort Berthold on it. It would be about in here, I think. So he went upstream to Fort Union, which is a trading post, and said, you need to protect me. You need to protect us. This is a commercial operation. 2 miles downstream further was, of course, this military post called Fort Buford, and it was created the same year, 1866. Now, of course, Fort Buford's well known because Sitting Bull surrendered there in 1881, so it's a very famous landmark. So I just going through documents, federal documents, and I found this amazing Assiniboine story. So here's this Indian agent. His name was Malan Wilkinson, and he's fearful of his life in the winter of 1866 to 1867. So he's up here at Fort Union, and all these Lakotas come and taunt Fort Union. And they say, you know, we just killed Captain Fetterman in northern Wyoming, December 21st of 1866, and they said, we're going to do the same thing to you that we did to Captain Fetterman, famous so-called Fetterman massacre, Fetterman battle, Fort Phil Kearny. But I read the documents, and they came down, and maybe it was just bluster. It didn't sound like it was bluster. And so what the document said was this agent went down 2 miles to Fort Buford and said, can you send a company up here to protect us at Fort Union? The commander at Fort Buford, it was just getting started. He said, you know, I can't even protect my own fort. He was worried about surviving the winter. He had so few soldiers in a military post. I mean, it's crazy. Does that make sense? He refused. So the Assiniboine part of the story was, we stood up and said, we'll protect you guys at Fort Union. There was nothing in it for us. And I've never seen, did we fight any Lakotas? Was there any combat involved? I'd never seen anything one way or another. But the fact of the matter is, we did that and we were glad to do it. No one else would do it. It's not significant in the scheme of things. But for me, we deserve credit for that. That's a good thing. Does that make sense? It's an unbelievable story. But anyway, so that interested me. And I always think about the Omaha people. The Omaha, when I worked with their elders, they always would say, the elders, they're so proud that they never fought against the white man. They're so proud of their unblemished record of being friends of the whites. It's true, as are many tribes. Anyway, we're one of those. I don't hear much of that back home, but it's exactly true for us. But maybe I'm missing out on that. Now, I brought this copy of an old book. I just want to say a few things about it, do a short version of it. It has my dad's name in it. It's his old book. And I didn't have time that I would put the name of the book up on PowerPoint. Wasn't going to happen. Things were kind of crazy. But so there's this book. It's called Land of Nakota. And the author was, his name was James Larpentour Long. And he was a Assiniboine mixed blood on the west end of the reservation. He wrote the book in 1942, but it's such a gorgeous, amazing book. So it was part of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, and it was what's called the Federal Writers Project. I don't remember much about the New Deal, but I mean the federal government was paying artists and writers to do things, and James Larpentour Long said, well, I'll do a history of Assiniboine. Does that make sense? And what's remarkable about the book is he was such a cultural, kind of educated Assiniboine. The whole book is oral history, and he just went to the elders. That make sense? I mean, this is just rare. This just doesn't really happen completely. So the book was reprinted in 1961 by Oklahoma Press. I love the title. I don't know if James Larpin Tourlong gave the title. The first book was called Land of Nakota, Our Name for Ourselves. Doesn't have a lot of zing to it, but the other title is really beautiful about oral history. So it's called The Assiniboines, From the Accounts of the Old Ones, Elders, Told to First Boy His Indian Name. Then they give his name, James Larpin Tourlong. Now, it's a great book because he says, here are the 25 Assiniboine elders. And if you knew the age or chose to write it down, we have the 25 names of the 25 elders and some things about them. That make sense? Listed them. That's his bibliography, these elders. And so the book was the stories that they told him, and it's kind of a hodgepodge of, you know, fun stories and cultural traditions and doing teepees. But there are a couple of historic accounts also. It just kind of had lots of things. So I had to put this in the notes about my dad. So I was thinking James Larpin Tourlong. He was born in 1888 when the reservation was formed. He's on the west end of the reservation. I mean, it's not a huge reservation. It's big. But so I asked my dad. I just loved this book and I played around with it. And I didn't know much anyway at the time. And so I asked my dad, hey, Dad, you ever heard of James Larpin Tourlong? My dad said, you mean Jimmy Long? He knew him well. I just didn't even know that. So he told me other things about him. You mean Jimmy Long? I was like, okay. Crack me up. So a couple things about one story in there. And so there's an elder, his name was Red Feather. He was 89 years old when he gave the story in 1939. To Jimmy Long. And the title of the story, I assume it's Jimmy James Larpin Tourlong's title. It's called Meeting the Sioux. It's an oral account by this elder named Red Feather. And a couple things here, because we don't have time for everything about it, or much of it even. But he says two things about this. He says, we were always enemies, he says, of the Sioux. And he just means, who knows? Probably mainly Yanktonnais Sioux, but who knows which Sioux, but usually it'd be the Yanktonnais and upper Yanktonnais Sioux. So he starts out and says, we're Assiniboine, they're Sioux, we're enemies, and we're enemies for a long time, which just seems to be true as far as I know. And then he said, someone told me that the first time we had a peaceful initiative with the Sioux, he says, I don't know the date, but I was told it happened. He said, four young men came to us. Poor young man. He didn't know their names and he didn't know other details, but he told us the region that it occurred. Does that make sense? Now that's straight oral tradition. That's what was told to him about the formative change of relations between two tribes. Okay, we don't have the date. So then he says what happened in his own experience when he was 13 years old. And it's an amazing story. He says, you know, I was 13 years old and I was with my Assiniboine band. He says, we were camped on the east side of the mouth of the White Earth River. Exactly the place. So it's a story about these very struggling, hungry Dakotas, Santee Sioux, who came in and his village fed them and took care of them. Does that make sense? And he said, from that moment on, we were friends with not just four Dakotas, but a whole community, a whole tribe, really. Okay, does that make sense? So the story is only about a page too long. It's unbelievably detailed and very important. And then, because I've spent a great deal of time looking at this Dakota group led by Chief Standing Bear, and what Red Feather said is exactly true. He's exactly correct. you can date. He said it was 18, a scholar, another sort of a self-taught scholar, did some very good homework and said you can date this to 1867. So we can date with assurance this event occurred at this place in 1867. And so you can date the change of relations between us, Assiniboine, and Santee Sioux. That's exactly what happened. And from that moment on, we lived with these Santees. We intermarried. We hunted together. Before that, I'm not sure it went so well. We were true allies. This is just an oral account. And so when I read this, and I'll move on, I was really disappointed because when I read that story in my mind, I thought, I was the one that discovered that. I looked at that story, and there was these Sioux that came, and I thought, I was the one that I looked at, and I said, no, that was Mark Diedrich, but I liked the story better than him, probably. But it was like, dang, I thought I was the guy. It wasn't me. Now, two things about the story. A travel delegation in 1872 from our reservation. It's a complicated process. This is 1872, and in the upper Missouri area, lower Yellowstone region here, this is 1872, eyes glazing over. This is a date long in the past. But 1872 is a significant date because the Northern Pacific Railroad is moving west, and primarily Sitting Bull and Hunkpapas and smaller tribes allied with Sitting Bull had control of the lower Yellowstone River, and everybody knew, and Sitting Bull said, there's no railroad coming through here. This is 1872. So the federal government, in its great denial, said, well, let's negotiate with Sitting Bull, and we'll sign a treaty because we want to come through the railroad, and we want to sign a peace treaty. Does that make sense? It's ridiculously unrealistic because he's not going to sign a treaty. That's what he just told them. Does that make sense? So it's just a total waste of money and time. So they sent a huge, impressive Treaty Commission delegation to came up to Montana in the summer of 1872. And they invited Sitting Bull to come. And any other prominent Hunkpapa chiefs, none showed up. I mean, it was such an insult. It was such a no-show. That was the whole point, was to negotiate with Sitting Bull and the Hunkpapas. Well, as it turns out, they're back in the lower Yellowstone attacking the survey parties coming up the Yellowstone. I mean, you couldn't make it up. It's too funny. So here's this treaty delegation, and it's a large delegation. It's a complicated delegation because as they took our northern Sioux people that came into the area, they're taking them off to D.C., they went down and picked up a Spotted Tail from the Rosebud Agency and a few others. So there's actually two things going on with this treaty delegation, but it was all about bringing them to Washington to sign a peace treaty so the railroad can come through the lower Yellowstone. That make sense? I mean, this didn't even get to first base, so they should have just not gone. I mean, what a waste of time. Does that make sense? There was no one that even could make the decision for them. There weren't even any Hunkpapas there. I mean, it's crazy. So the agent who I really have high regard for, Andrew J. Simmons, the Fort Peck agent, he's one of the finer Indian agents I've ever seen. He happened to be at our agency, absolutely competent, pretty bright, and kind of fair and thoughtful. And so he got to go with this party. And it's not clear to me, at some point they got on the Northern Pacific Railroad and took that in to Chicago. I don't quite understand what they did, but they went down the Missouri probably by steamboat, went to the present Standing Rock Reservation, and then some way, I guess, they got on the NP, went to D.C. So he told the story I could not believe. And so this is Simmons writing after they returned from three months in D.C. And so he said, when we returned, every time we went through a tunnel, a railroad tunnel, it sounded like it was black. I mean, no light. Does that make sense? He said one of the leaders, and I don't know anything about him, his name was Goodhawk. And Goodhawk took off his breechcloth, his pitch black, and he shaked it in the faces of these other chiefs because no one could see who it was. Does that make sense? Just totally having fun. And then when the light came on, then he was part of like, well, who did that? And then and then Agent Simmons said that they accused him of doing it. They're just teasing and playing with him. Does that make sense? It's an unbelievable document. Now, in the cultural world that I live, I mean, Indian people are so much fun. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's so much fun. You wouldn't see that in most documents. Does that make sense? I have been through a lot of documents. I have never seen anything like this, and I've never seen it in secondary literature. You can find some witty things, to be sure. This is just a prank. I mean, it's just too funny. I couldn't believe I was reading the document. So you heard it first here. Anyway, Goodhawk, and before all my photographs and everything on my Mac melted down last night, I actually have a picture of him. Well, we won't be doing that, but that's disappointing. Now, a couple of stories, and then, because I don't want to run excessively over. And on this delegation, this is in the summer of 1872, and they were there about in D.C. apparently about a month or 6 weeks or something to that effect. So I went to D.C., and I've been trying for years and years and years to find out about this Agent Simmons. I went through ridiculous amounts of documents trying to track down Agent Simmons, and there was nothing. Well, that's frustrating. So when I went to D.C. about 3 years ago, I thought, well, maybe because they were so long, maybe someone took a photograph, you know, like a group picture that some of these treaty delegations had. I mean, that would be unbelievable. So there wasn't anything like that. But then I went to the local D.C. newspaper called the Evening Star and did all the microfilm. Am I off? I'm on. Anyway, so I went to this, you know, little tiny snippets and tracked their experiences in D.C. I mean, just little tiny things in this newspaper, and there was an amazing thing. So I want to read to you what it said. So this is I assume it's most of these delegations, clearly us at the Fort Peck region, these are all Sioux. Here's the title of the little caption: Shaking Hands with the Spirit of the Great Father. Shaking Hands with the Spirit of the Great Father. And here's what the little caption said. Our Indian guests paid a visit to the tomb of Washington, George Washington, at Mount Vernon yesterday and seemed delighted to be there for a time from the heat and dust of the Capitol. So it was a little cooler there. It was along the Potomac. On their way down the river, they were told that they were going to visit the tomb of the first great father. On their arrival at the tomb, each Indian walked up to the door, and I can't read the next word, but it's a great, it sounds like kind of a great at the tomb, but I can't read the word. And so each Indian walked up to the door of the tomb, and it sounded like some kind of a grill or something, passing his right hand through the word, another word I can't read. I assume it's rated, just terrible photocopy, as if shaking the hand of a friend. When asked by the interpreter what they were doing, their reply was, "We are shaking hands with the spirit of the Great Father." I mean, I was just flabbergasted. Does that make sense? Now, one comment on this, and let's do one other story, and I'll be done. What strikes me about this is, my impression is, we are simplistic and condescending about tribes, about certain things. And I'm thinking about the Great Father. I understand that's the way tribal people thought about them. But my impression is there's just something condescending about that. There's something childlike. There's something, does that make sense? I just get the impression that's not as respectful as it could be. Meaning, that's not the way Native people thought about it. Same term. Does that make sense? So I say that in that I think this is a very important moment. And it's very symbolic. And what I mean by that is that if you look at tribes in two centuries or whatever working with the federal government, they treated the Great Father, good, bad, and ugly, whoever those presidents were and the like, they treated him with the highest respect. That's why they call him a Great Father. That's why they call him a father. That make sense? And so to me, my guess is that tribes are operating from their worldview. And the tribal worldview is we have leaders who are chiefs. We revere them. We honor them. That make sense? That's the way I see it. And so when any visitor would come into a tribe, come into a community, they were treated with high regard. But if you're a dignitary, tribe, or treaty commissioner, whoever, you were so taken care of and given hospitality. It's not because you're special. It's because you're a guest. Because we honor you. And if you are a dignitary, tribal or not, you are so respected. I mean, this village is yours, anything that you want. And the point I'm making is this is all about respect. It's about the cultural belief. If we dumb it down to this is the Great Father and you know, simple Indian thinking and what have you, it misses the whole point. The point is, tribes always had respect for that place. He's the highest chief. And that's how we would treat a Red Cloud, a Spotted Tail, a Medicine Bear, in exactly the same way. So my impression is tribes wouldn't be colonized in their thinking and thinking any other way of the Great Father as much as they would criticize the Great Father. Does that make sense? So that's me thinking, but I think that's the case because I don't know how else you explain it. Why would they go to such great lengths? He's the original Great Father, and they're shaking his hand. It's unbelievable. So I'm arguing it's out of respect. And I don't know how you could see it otherwise. One thing, and then we're done. So in December of 1998, because I have a good doctoral advisor, Dr. Wunder told me when I was organizing how to do my dissertation on Fort Peck, he said, you know, you should go interview some elders. It was like, gee, I never thought about that. You know, didn't know anything. And so John thought it was a good idea. Well, I went and interviewed elders, of course. And I was just doing history to 1888. And it was unbelievable, that experience. So I got to go back home and interview five elders. I've never really been the same since. I had such a great experience interviewing an oral tradition. I mean, it was amazing. So I interviewed one of my relatives. It was my dad's first cousin. And I want to tell you very briefly the story. And I want to be respectful to her. She told me the story. It's an unbelievable story. She would not let me write about it. It was such a stunning story. She wouldn't let me write about it, so I didn't write about it. And she passed away, and I'm not going to mention her name out of regard for her, but I got to tell the story. Okay, that makes sense? So she was talking to me about this incredible story. She's just a girl. She's 10 years old. I think she said 10. Age 10. She was born 1 year after my father. She was born in 1909. So this is probably around 1919. She's a little 10-year-old, mixed blood, Assiniboine girl. Her grandmother, named Hale Woman, this is a traditional Assiniboine woman. Her mother's mother. She was married to two very traditional Assiniboine. They live right next door, and they were old school in every way, because she told me all about them. Those were absolutely traditional people who didn't speak much English, spoke primarily Assiniboine. So she's a little 10-year-old girl. She comes back from school every day, and she'd always walk into the kitchen and say to her mom, Mom, I'm back from school. And so she went to her grandmother and said, you know, I'd like to surprise my mom. I'd like to see that in Assiniboine just once. So she secretly went to Hale Woman and Fisk, I forget his first name, Clinton Fisk, and they worked with her and worked with her to just say that in Assiniboine. Does that make sense? And then she told me what happened. You know, she's thinking this is going to be awesome. And so she walks in, and she's been working and working. She's got absolutely perfect. And she walks home, and she just, in a casual way, says this thing in sin. But I'm going to tell you what she said. And she said her mother just, her whole face changed. And she became furious. You know, she thought this is going to be fun. And her mother's face just changed, and her mother said, don't ever do that again. Don't ever speak of sin to anyone. Don't ever do that again. And then the thing I really remember, she says, we live in the white world now. Does that make sense? I mean, it's a classic story, but that's exactly what she said. Does that make sense? Here's the remarkable thing, and then we're done. So when she came in, I mean, I've been around the language a lot. I don't claim to be a speaker, but I understand the language, I understand the sounds and the like. So here's this relative of mine. I interviewed her in 98, so she was 90 years old, just sharp as a tack. And this occurred 80 years ago. She, of course, never spoke of sin and born again. Of course. Does that make sense? So when she told me the story, out came that Assiniboine thing that she was taught 80 years ago. She'd never said before, again. Does that make sense? So she said, Ina, wa yawa, waksni, wa na. She said it exactly that way, absolutely, perfectly, beautifully. Perfect nasalization, perfect accent on the right words. It came out in just gorgeous Assiniboine. She hadn't spoken it in 80 years. It was exactly what she told her mom. Does that make sense? So that was too much for me. So the point of all this and my emphasis on oral stories is when I interviewed elders, these things would happen. Something would come out in a Sinhalese language or in an old way that they remembered from so long ago. Does that make sense? So that's what struck me, because I'm such a strong believer in oral history and accuracy, at least in times. And so I see that here.